traditionally in the summer, Northern Soundings takes a break. This year is different, however. I'm delighted to reintroduce a new generation to a wonderful series KUAC broadcast some 30 years ago. Sunday at Noon, later morphing into Conversations, featured Susan McGuinness talking with some of the most important and thoughtful people at the time about Alaska. Susan has selected some 6 former discussions for this summer series. Before we hear their discussion, I spoke with Susan about her show's origins.
I was working in 1983 or 1984 at WICCA, Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance. It's now the Interior Center for Nonviolent Living. I was the public lecturer and I was the writer of grant narratives, but I spent a lot of time in the community talking to people about domestic violence, sexual assault, abuses of children. It was really good work, and it was also grim. So appeared in my basement office one day, Patty Kostelic, longtime supporter of KUAC, early on-air person. She appears in my office with a woman who is over 6 feet tall, large and imposing. The two of them had this idea. There was a wonderful program out of Minnesota Public Radio that had 4 30-minute shows on sexual abuse of children. But Carla had heard them and thought they were a good way to talk about this issue. And Carla and Patty knew each other, and they came to me. Carla said, put something together for the other 30 minutes, and we'll run this show. And I thought, oh, what an opportunity. And so I found people who worked in child sexual abuse. So there was a therapist, and there was someone from the DA's office, and a defense attorney, and there was a social worker, people from Fairbanks who were really good at what they did in that business. We all sat down at a table, we listened to the first half hour, and then for the next half hour, we opened up the phones in Fairbanks, Alaska, and talked about child sexual abuse. And it was stunning. The program just felt like it opened up the community, and people called and talked about something that people didn't talk about. So I drove home crying and laughing that afternoon. I'd never experienced such a thing. It just opened up a world of sound for me. So I slowly transferred myself to KUAC as a volunteer. Some years later, Conversations was born. And that took over my life for about 8.5 years and was this wonderful, hard labor of love.
Now, you had been a journalist before. Where did your style of interviewing people and engaging in long conversation?
Oh, Robert, I had no style of interviews. I found, probably on radio and in public television, my examples. I listened to Bob Costa, who is a sports interviewer and is extraordinary. Charlie Rose was an exceptional host for PBS at the time. I would sit at home and just listen to these guys and put them on cassettes in my truck when I was driving. And slowly, I think it took 2 years before I knew what I was doing. And after that, it was hard work, but such fun.
Do you miss it?
No, but I think that's part of my character. I don't think I long so much for things. I loved it, absolutely, if I had that opportunity again. But that opportunity was so much born out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks at the time, KUAC at the time, and then something grew. So I don't think you can miss something that happens like that.
Susan McGuinness discussing her start in broadcasting. Let's hear now her 1990 discussion with broadcast legend Augie Hebert, who died in 2007.
Augie Hebert built Fairbanks' first radio station. It was the third AM station in the territory, KFAR. Later, Mr. Hebert built Alaska's first television station. That was in Anchorage. He also put the first FM station in the state, also in Anchorage, and he brought Muzak to Anchorage. Augie Hebert was instrumental in bringing satellite technology to Alaska. Those are not his only innovations, but it is a short list. We'll get to some of the others as we move along through the hour. Over 50 years, Augie Hebert has amassed a small broadcasting empire. 2 television and 3 radio stations, the subscriber Muzak channel I mentioned, and most recently, a retail video store. He is a self-taught engineer. He has been known as an innovator, willing to take personal risks to reach goals. And he's also been honored for the community service that has gone hand in hand with pioneering efforts in radio and television in Alaska. Augie Hebert, it's lovely to have you on Sunday at noon today. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Susan.
Thanks. I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. Be glad to be with you for the next hour on KUAC-FM. When you first arrived in the territory, well, the territory was only 27 years old. It had been established in 1912. Fairbanks was only 10 years older than that, a gold rush town founded in 1902. I'm interested in what you saw or what struck you about the territory as you came up.
Well, I think, in the realm of telecommunications, I think the story I like to tell that shows a contrast of what it was like then compared to now had to do with my trip up here from Valdez. I came by boat from Seattle to Valdez, stayed overnight there, then got on a rickety little bus that came up the Richardson Highway, which was a very safe highway in those days because it was a single winding road, single wide, and you'd never get killed if you had a head-on accident because you didn't go fast enough to get hurt. But we had to also stay overnight, and we stayed overnight at Black Rapids Lodge, which was a nice big log lodge in those days. And what struck me along the way was I kept looking at the telephone line for Valdez to Black Rapids Lodge, and it was on a tripod of poles. You know, spruce trees were cut down and made into a tripod, and there were 2 wires on it, which was a metallic system. Got to Black Rapids, and I noticed going in the other direction toward Fairbanks, there were tripods with 1 wire on it, which meant it was a grounded system.
Uh-huh.
You can't hook those 2 together. So that meant that Black Rapids was a relay point. We went inside and had dinner. In the middle of dinner, the phone rang. I looked on the wall, and there were 2 telephones there, old-fashioned crank phones. And the lady that ran the lodge was named Sue Revelle, and she answered the phone, and she said, okay, and rang the other phone. And it turns out it was a human repeater. She, everything that was said in Valdez, she had to repeat verbally at the top of her voice into the microphone to go to Fairbanks and vice versa. So everybody that sat there knew at least what her side of the conversation was. Mm-hmm. And here Fairbanks was, well, Valdez was really the port of Fairbanks. A lot of trucking went back and forth. And the Alaska Railroad had a rail line system, but Fairbanks got a lot of its material and produce out of Valdez. And that was the state of telecommunications then. And to look at it now, you know, satellite communications and so forth. So that contrast sticks in my mind is what can happen in, you know, one person's telecommunications lifetime. Fairbanks was 3,500 people. There wasn't a paved street here. There wasn't a paved sidewalk here. There were no paved roads, no roads at all between Anchorage and Fairbanks. They came later. And something you'd recognize, the main street was torn up. They were putting in some pipes or something. How many times has that happened since?
It always is.
That was Fairbanks in those days.
Cap Lathrop brought you up.
Yes.
Austin Lathrop was a not a gold miner, but a very successful riverboat captain who took stores to gold miners and other people who needed him up and down the Chena.
Well, he was pretty smart. He was early on. Well, his main boating experience, where he got the name of Cap, was bringing people to and from Alaska, from Seattle. He decided early on that digging the stuff was a little risky, and not everybody made it that way. So, you know, if the miners are going to go and supplies had to go, the better thing is to have a regular business. So he started the shipping business. Then he, when he left that field, he decided that things were needed in Fairbanks and Anchorage. And some of the things that were needed, theaters. He built the first theater here. And he built a building that still stands. And although the critic says a concrete building would not work in this ice zone, he built it. And when Uncle Sam saw that and it worked, then they built the first, the federal building downtown on 2nd and Cushman In Anchorage, you built the first concrete building there. No one would build a concrete foundation building there because they said the earthquakes would destroy it. He built the first building there, and then the federal building was built there, too. The Empress Theater in Fairbanks had many of other uses because Fairbanks continually burned down, and the theater continually stopped the fire there. And it,
because it was concrete.
Concrete, so in both directions. It was, Cap was a visionary. He's a marvelous person. He was a great influence on me, and he contributed so much to this country that it's really too bad that there more hasn't been done to memorialize what Cap meant to the country, and that more hasn't been written about him to give him credit for what he did for it.
They said he was the wealthiest man in the state, and one of the reasons that he was so respected was that, unlike other people who took a great deal of money out of the state and invested elsewhere, he invested his money just in Alaska.
That's right. I don't think he had any investments outside. He had considerable investments in Anchorage. To show you the kind of vision he had, Anchorage was also a population of 3,500 at the same time. He had the Empress Theater, which is a fairly good-sized theater, but in 1941 he started building the Fourth Avenue Theater, which was a beautiful, beautiful structure. It's now a National Heritage Building that would seat 1,100 people in a town of 3,500. That takes some sort of vision. It was not finished until after the war, but it still filled up. Of course, the town grew a bit, which he expected, and you could still see lines of people outside to get into that theater. That's the kind of vision he had. Yeah. Same with the radio station here that he built, KFAR. The finest equipment. Before the radio station started here, he built the Fourth Avenue Theater building, so there'd be apartments for his people and others to live in. The transmitter building out on Farmers Loop Road that Stan Bennett was the chief engineer and I was his assistant. Where that equipment was, he built an apartment there for us to live in. It was the finest apartment in town. It was a show place. We had a lot of visitors that wanted to just come out and see the apartment. The building was very solid, and that's Cap.
He said it was real important for him to break the isolation that Alaskans felt, that we could pull a great many resources out of the ground, but our inner resources at that time weren't strong enough to link us.
Well, you know, the problem in those days largely was the lack of amenities. And I ran into this later along the way, and it made such an impression on me. It was one of the main reasons I went into television later on. And that's this. This country is very attractive to men because there's so much to do. You can keep busy doing this and that and the other things, and men are more gregarious anyway. But when you hire someone from outside and he brings his wife up, now some women adjust to Anchorage and Fairbanks quite well. Others who have pretty close apron strings to home would, and if they didn't get involved in community activities, and there are plenty of them there if they wanted to, if they're inclined. But if they didn't, they would feel the isolation. They'd complain about not having this and not having that. And pretty soon you had a family problem, and we would lose good men. They'd either go back outside, or there'd be a family problem. There'd be a divorce, a separation. And it was, we simply had to do something. And Cap was realized this from way back. Things had to be done to make this place comparable to other places, to attract and keep good people, and that to keep a family relationship that was healthy.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about KFAR.
Well, KFAR was unique. It provided a service here that people just couldn't believe. You know, before there was radio here, the propagation was such that you couldn't hear radio stations from other places. When we started it, there were no other radio stations around, so we could do what we thought the public wanted, and we did. We did a lot of remote broadcasts. We covered the dog races. We did many remotes with the military, unusual remotes. We put on music that would appeal to everyone at one time or another, and we innovated some things that hadn't been done before. One of them, probably the best concept in a radio program to serve the remote areas, was Tundra Topics. Where, while it was illegal for a broadcast station to send messages back and forth, in the absence of that, we were able to do it. And every night there's a 15-minute program where, you know, Susie has a baby. You told the family back there that everything was fine. That program was a real service to Undertopics. When we started KUNI in Anchorage, we did a program there called Muckluck Telegraph, same thing. Another thing we did was weather was so important, and flying, the bush flying. We had a weather program that would tell people what the weather was like in our coverage area, and a plane movements program that was vital for people in remote areas, because you might have a mine that was 10 miles from a landing field. And if the plane would come out and dump the material off, by the time you'd get there, a bear might have gotten into it. So we would tell where all of these bush planes were flying. We'd call the airlines every day, the bush lines, and so they could be out there to meet the plane and take their merchandise. Those were some of the things we did that were of great service to the public.
So radio in that way was definitely an outreach community. We think of it as news, sports, and entertainment now, but yes. This is something where you actually reach the people's needs.
Well, we did all of that, too, but the measure of how we pleased them, we felt, Stan and I at the transmitter, because people would come out. We had a guest book out there, and, you know, here again, a population of 3,500 in the first year there. We signed up hundreds of people that wanted to come out, see the transmitter, and of course, the announcers made fun of us, kind of. We were batching. The two of us were single, and we were known as the starvation twins. So we had a lot of invitations to dinners, and people would bring out cookies and cakes and stuff. But we noticed people would take a cab out that came into town from the bush, the grubstake, annual grubstake. And it wasn't cheap. They brought it, came out, and they said, "We wanted to come out, tell you fellas thanks for bringing radio to us."
Nice.
We'd say, go say, tell Cap thanks. You know, it's his. He said, yeah, Cap paid for it. But he said, Cap couldn't solder it together. He couldn't build it. You guys build it.
Yeah.
And they said, we want you to know how much it means to us, because now we get news, religion, music, everything we want. And we're not isolated like that out there anymore. It means a lot to us. So it really scored in those days.
We're talking today with Augie Hebert. He's known as a father of broadcasting in the state of Alaska and in the territory. He was the first president of the Alaska Broadcasters Association, among other things. He organized ABA in 1964. One short question for you that's been on my mind. Somebody said that the call letters for KFAR are for K Fairbanks with first three letters. And then someone else said that Cap Lathrop thought that KFAR stood for Key to Alaska's Riches.
Key for Alaska.
Key for Alaska's Riches. I knew something was wrong there.
It was a contest. They wanted to know what to call the station. So there was a contest. And this was before I got here. The call letters had already been set by the time I arrived. But there was a contest, and people came up with an idea what call letters could be, what were available, and what they might stand for. And that was chosen, Key for Alaska's Riches. And a brochure about 14 inches by 11 inches was published with all kinds of material in it telling what the territory was, what the industry was, what the population was. And that book then was used to try and solicit national advertising sales and so on. But Key for Alaska's Riches was chosen, and it was kind of a coincidence that FAR kind of sounds like Fairbanks.
Right. Okay. You did the news at 10:30 while you were DJing at the station. I understand there was no teletype at that time.
There was no teletype, and the way we got news was by Transradio Press. And Transradio Press was a system of worldwide dissemination news by International Morse Code. Very fast, came in 45, 50 words a minute. Stan was, both he and I were radio amateurs, and that's where we knew code. Stan was much better at it than I, and he could copy this stuff right off the bat. So he had to do it. I had to bring my speed up from an amateur. All you needed was 13 words a minute. And that other stuff is so fast. So I had to practice a lot, and I dragged my feet a little bit because Stan finally put the pressure on. So I finally started copying it. 4 hours in the morning and 4 hours in the afternoon. And that's a real drag because you have to concentrate. You don't copy by letters or words. You copy by sentences. And the war came along, and we got in all those Polish and Czechoslovak names with a bunch of C's and Z's. And I'm not sure, but what I didn't invent a bunch of of new cities for the, because they come to a word, one of those, and then you repeat it. But you were catching up to that word by the time you got there. And I don't know how many of those cities I got right.
For a fellow who was an innovator, is an innovator, it must have been frustrating to sit and do longhand what you could conceive that should happen more quickly.
Oh, that was the only part about KFAR that I didn't care for. It really was a terribly enervating type of job. It was just awful. It went on for 4 years. We didn't get radio teletype until AP came in, put it in 1943. And that was a happy day when we could put away that transradio press copy. Oh.
You did another thing by sleight of hand that I've heard a lot of all over the United States, and that's sports recreation. There was a fellow who, now, you'll have to remember his name
for me. Bud Foster.
Yeah. He bragged his way into the job. I understand he was down in Juneau, and he was an odd jobber, a driver, and various sorts of things for the docks, and sitting in a bar one night, and he was saying how he could do a better job than the guy coming over the radio. And lo and behold, somebody came up and said, I understand you're a sportscaster, son. Why don't you go to work? But the funny thing was, he was good.
He was very good. To be good at what he did, you had to know the sport very well.
Inside and out.
And you had to have a lot of imagination, and he had both. So the way we got that those games on the air was we had an arrangement with the team that was broadcasting. They'd make a 25-word or about a 25-word capsule of what went on per inning and sent up by telegraph, by Alaska Communications System. Telegraph system was in the federal building on 2nd and Cushman, and we were, you know, on 2nd and Lacey, in the Lacer building. And what Bud had for sound effects was a 16-inch platter with the crowd noise that he'd run up and down. The sound of the bat was a little piece of wood with a pencil. It sounded just like it.
Great.
And the sound of the ball in the catcher's mitt was a roll of toilet paper that you hit with a pencil. It sounded just like the ball hitting the catcher's mitt. And he would recreate the game using just the bare statistics. And that we did for quite some time. And the classic game of all time occurred one time when we had a runner, a young fellow, that would go over to get these telegrams as they came in. Then he'd run over and give them to Bud, and Bud, one day he didn't come back from the telegraph company. Turned out that they had there was a fade-out or there was a failure, and no more stuff came in. Well, here he was in the fourth inning, so he had rain delays, and he had this delay. And finally he decided, you know, he's got to go on. So he recreated the rest of the game out of his imagination. We never did find out what the final score was. But the game ended, and that was that, and nobody really cared.
And somebody won, and it was a great game, right?
Sure, a marvelous game, one of Bud's best. Then he could use his imagination entirely.
You said later about television, that the early television in Alaska, that in the early days you didn't worry about ratings, you didn't worry about surveys. You worried about what the community wanted and what you folks wanted to do as people who were broadcasters. This is a question I wanted to ask you later in the program, but is that that spark of imagination and innovation gone forever in these days of ratings and surveys and heavy competition for advertisers?
Well, it's not gone forever, but it's badly bent out of shape for several reasons. For one thing, in early days of KFAR, when we did all these remotes and put the music on, a little bit of everything that we thought people would like, in the evening we had a classical concert hour and so forth. We didn't have to worry about whether we were competing with somebody else and whether we had the numbers or not. We knew we reached somebody that liked it some time of the day or other. Well, when competition comes in, then eventually get into the rating services. And in order to sell advertising, then you're working against another yardstick, and that's how many listeners you have or later in TV viewers. And then beyond that, what the demographics are, whether there's an age group you try and reach, it gets very complicated. When you get a lot of radio stations and a lot of TV stations in a market, then it's more specialized and more specialized and more specialized, and you're cutting the advertising pie very small. And both Anchorage and Fairbanks have a lot more radio and TV stations per capita than any place else. What happens then is that you can't go out and innovate because you can't afford to. Mm-hmm. The economics are very, very tough. The economics of radio especially are extremely difficult right now. TV isn't so bad. TV is pretty good. But radio stations are having a tough time.
And is TV pretty good because you can charge a higher dollar for the advertising minute?
Well, there's not so much competition that you can't find the advertisers to support you. There are just a limited number of channels available, and So you can't go beyond what's reasonable for that market size. So the trouble with it is when you can't do what you really want to do because it costs so much and you have to watch your bottom line so much, that the public suffers. You just can't do the public affairs things anymore. We still do them as much as we can, but they're not as innovative and they're not as creative, and there are not as many of them because of those kind of programs. You can't compete with a network entertainment program, and they don't get on in prime time when you have the most listeners or viewers. So it's from that standpoint, a good part of their early day radio and even early day TV, it's disappeared. And I'm sorry to see that, because radio, for me, was the most fun, most creative, and most productive, and most appreciated thing I've ever done in my whole life. And I really loved it.
You wanted to go into television in, shortly after Cap Lathrop's death. You decided that it was time for this territory of Alaska to have a television station. The executors of Mr. Lathrop's estate said, no, it's going to compete with radio and it's going to compete with theaters. It's not a good idea. You think he would have thought it would have been a good idea, is that right?
Well, had Cap been alive, he would have done it. Yeah. Cap didn't worry about things like that, but the people he left to run his estate just didn't come anywhere close to filling his shoes. They didn't have the imagination, and they were afraid for theaters and radio, but there is an arrogance there that was underlined their decision, too. And that was, they said, you know, the Lathrop Company is very dominant and looked up to. We know how things are and how they should be. If we don't put television in, nobody else will think of it and do it. And consequently, why should we trigger off this thing that might be damaging? Huh. I thought that was, that told me that the Lathrop Company was never going to be what it was again, just perfectly clear. So what I did was I went out, and incidentally, Cap left me $25,000 in his will, and I used that and borrowed some more and went out and sold stock and put the first television station on the air in Anchorage. The irony of this, nobody else will think of it, was that I applied for the station to the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, in May of 1953. A week later, a California company applied, so much for nobody else will think of it. And they tried their best to get on the air first, and they didn't make it. We were on the air first. We got on the air in December 11th, in Anchorage. And we were the first television in the state of Alaska. But they came on later on. They didn't. They were later bought out by the Lathrop interest because they saw it was going to be successful. They really weren't making it. They had put in some junk equipment that wasn't working very well. So they were about to close it down, and by then the Lathrop Company saw it as viable, and they went into competition with me.
Which I thought was the supreme irony. That,
oh, you bet.
Only a couple of years down the road, they turned around and said, probably not, oops, we were wrong, but this gentleman definitely has a good idea.
Well, what they said to me, and I won't name the names of the people that talked to me this way, they said, first of all, it went well in Anchorage for us, and then the Fairbanks friends of mine came down and said, gee, we like TV up there, too. I said, well, have you talked to the Lathrop Company? No, Midnight Sun Broadcast. They said, no, they don't. There has been one of them gave a speech at the Chamber of Commerce saying that, well, maybe it's successful in Anchorage, but Fairbanks is too small. So I came up and talked to some of the people here, and they bought more stock in the company. We want one here, too. And I went to the Lathrop Company. I said, now, we got into competition with this California outfit in Anchorage right away. Two stations in Anchorage was pretty dicey, and two in Fairbanks could be disastrous. Oh, no. You may have been right in Anchorage, Augie, but Fairbanks, years before, one station, much less two, so don't worry about it. Well, I filed for the station in September, ordered the equipment, and in October, Midnight Sun bought out these California operators and had to replace all the equipment in Anchorage except a couple of filing cabinets and a car. And they had a construction permit in Fairbanks, and they took that over. Then they were going to beat me on the air up here, which they didn't do either. So the first TV station in Fairbanks went on here, KTVF, Channel 11, February 17th, 1955. So Fairbanks was into it fairly early on, too.
You're listening to an archive edition of Sunday at Noon that originally aired in 1990.
We're talking to Augie Hebert. He did put the first television station in Anchorage, also Fairbanks' first television station the year following. A reminder, he's the founder of radio station KFAR in 1939 when he got this broadcasting and innovating life going. I bet you it was hard to economically to keep competing stations going in two towns.
Oh, we were on the ragged edge of extinction for 25 years.
Expensive proposition.
Yes, it's expensive, and the town was really very small for one, much less two, and I don't really know how we did it. We didn't pay very high salaries, and the advertisers couldn't afford very much, but we operated on sort of a lean budget and somehow managed to keep it going. We didn't pay bills very fast in those days, but we did keep it going, and later on when the town grew larger and could support it, it worked fine. In Anchorage, the same way. In Anchorage, actually, we have five stations plus a couple of low-power UHF stations, and that's a lot of stations for that size market, too, but we're doing very well down there, too.
Good. Plus cable.
Plus a lot of cable, both in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
This is another later question, but I'll ask it now. Did cable throw a wrench in the works in terms of local ownership of stations and the solvency?
Well, if you the rules of the game, Federal Communications Commission rules would not allow a broadcast station, TV station, to own cable. So there's no way we could get into cable in the same marketplace. I could own cable in some other city where I didn't have TV. But cable came about anyway, and I guess maybe your question is, has it affected us? Mm-hmm. We can't really see that it's affected us very much at all. There are lots of competition on cable, and cable now is selling advertising, which is the ultimate irony, because when cable started, they went around thumping their breasts and beating their back on, well, you know, we're going to put this programming on Pure without all those nasty commercials that TV stations put on. Now they're selling commercials, and commercials come in on national cable channels all over the place. But they're selling them at a price that may compete with radio more than TV. They're very cheap. But the trouble is, if you have 25 channels out there and you scatter the commercials all around, you don't have much contact with any one channel at any one time. So that people still like to tune into entertainment, news, sports, and stuff that come in on the free TV. Mm-hmm. So free TV has survived quite well all over the countryside, and we don't really look at cable as much of a threat. It may be, in a sense, a good alternative, because there are very good programs on cable, and some of the best ones are the early day TV ones that are very family oriented, mm-hmm. clean, and a good alternative to some of the TV programming now that you don't want in your living room.
So you can just flip it and move
you
it
bet.
If you don't like it.
You bet.
Yeah. You had a couple of major disasters that were also major disasters, not to be understated, for people in the rest of the state, but both the Anchorage, what is called the Anchorage earthquake, and the Fairbanks flood just tore up your broadcasting business, didn't they?
Yeah, I began to think somebody up there didn't really care that much for me. Right. The earthquake, we were in the McKinley building, a 14-story building in Anchorage, and while it didn't damage our equipment, it did ruin the building, and it took us off the air for a week because every pipe in the building broke, and we wound up with the water running through our transmitter. Then the power went off, and we couldn't get anything in there to dry it off. So we finally got power back and dried things out and went back on the air, but we were the only people in that building, a whole big building, for 2 years until we found something else.
My understanding is that you were wearing hard hats and using space heaters to heat yourself? Hard hats so the building wouldn't fall on you? Is that the case?
Well, it looked like a bomb shelter, and we felt that it's the thing to do. We didn't know when stuff would fall off. The ceilings were cement and plaster, and there wasn't an apartment building in that building that you couldn't walk from one room to the other. The inside walls were all just gone. Mm-hmm. So we, our romper room program, which used kids, were with teachers, no kids. They just taught the kids at home and so forth and so on. How we heated the building, there was no central heat. We were in the apartment building. We had taken over several apartment spaces and a bunch of little rooms. So what we did is we got oil heaters and put them in each one of these rooms and stuck the chimney out the window, like the Toonerville trolley that went out the caboose. Right. Well, we turned these things on, and the tall building has funny wind around it, and we get a negative feedback. The wind would blow out you'd have soot all over the place, and the fires would go out. So what we finally did is we connected all these chimneys around the building to a feeder pipe that went into the second floor of the building, down hall, and into the incinerator shaft, and there we had a 14-story chimney. They burned fine. In the studio, we couldn't do that, so we had to get space heaters that would heat the thing up before the kids' program would go on. Any news or live program, a woman's program going on at the time, heat it up, then turn it all off, and then the lights, the incandescent lights, would keep it hot till the program was over. So that's how we got through the earthquake. The flood was very damaging. Of course, in order to move, we had to buy land and buy a building and buy a tower and so forth. So it was very expensive, and we were able to get a small business disaster loan in order to do that in Anchorage and got back into business there. So we had our own building by 1966, 2 years later.
And that was a good move for you. You put your AM, your FM, and your TV transmitter all in one place and consolidated.
Well, we had FM at the time of the earthquake. We started that in 1960. That, as you mentioned, and you're right, it was the first FM station in Alaska, too. But we didn't have AM. But the land we bought had a radio station on it and also was owned, KFRB up here was owned by the same owner. The reason we bought that land was I went to the Federal Aviation Authority and said, where can I put up a tall tower? Because, you know, we have 8 runways down there, one description or another, and they drew a circle out in Spinard, and it happened to be where this radio station was on 2 acres of land, and it wasn't doing very well, and the fellow wanted to sell. So we negotiated and finally made a deal, and that's what got me into the radio business then in 1965, both in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
You were in the basement, if I remember right, of the Northward building when the Fairbanks flood hit, and I read that your equipment was under 14 feet of water.
That's right. The water outside the building was to the top of the parking meters, and the only thing that was saved was the antenna. Of course, that's on top of the building. So after I got down in the basement, and several things happened, although regardless of whether it happened or not, we were still out of business because of the water damage. But down in the basement was the storeroom of all full of chemicals of the drugstore that was on the main floor. And the other thing that happened is the water pressure built up so much on the street that a corner of the building collapsed, and the water came in a great big rush and knocked down our studio walls and just trashed everything. So between the chemicals and the water pressure and everything, it took care of all that stuff, and when we finally got to looking at it, there was nothing there to save. So we had insurance that covered part of the equipment replacement. But in order to get away from the basement, we went up to the second story. This was in August, and we finally got the TV station back on the air November 9th. It wasn't completely finished, but we were able to do everything but live studio stuff. The radio station that we bought just 2 years earlier, out on Farmers Loop Road, that the water got into that too, and the 10,000 watt transmitter there, it ruined all the transformers. We had to buy a new transmitter for that and some other stuff, and we went on in a week with the auxiliary power rig, a low power transmitter, until we got the new 10,000 watt transmitter on in November. So that was expensive. We're still paying off part of that. The Anchorage bill has all been paid, but we're still paying SBA, another SBA loan up here.
20-plus years later.
That's a 30-year loan. So ours will be paid off in another few years here. But the one up here was really a disaster. It did one good thing for us, though. When we bought new equipment, color had come about. Color equipment had been invented in the meantime, and this was a good way to force yourself to upgrade to color, which we did.
You know, I'm curious about you. You seem to be comfortably on the cutting edge, and I say comfortably on the cutting edge. It seems to me that you're looking around for the next best new thing that's coming along, and when it comes along, you want to try it. Is that the case with
you?
Well,
I don't know whether I'm looking around for it or whether it seems like a natural thing to do. You know, I mentioned the amenity situation. Mm-hmm. I thought, and most of the stockholders said the same thing that they went to. Look, if TV is popular outside and we don't have it, it's something we don't have, and it's going to bother these ladies again or bother a lot of people. If we do have it, at least we have a comparable situation. We have a fighting chance to keep people satisfied that we're not at the end of the world here. There are isolation problems up here. We have the lack of light in the wintertime and so forth. There's some things you can't do anything about. But it seemed like the thing to do. And while at that time, that early on, there were no stations, TV stations, in markets the size of Anchorage, much less Fairbanks, it seemed like such a compelling reason to do it and such a good idea to do it, although that there was a risk, and the stockholders, I told them, I don't know if it'll go broke. I don't know if you'll ever see any money back from this at all. Mm-hmm. But it was a case, it's a thing to do, so you do it.
And is personal risk a lesser value for you?
I don't mind the risk. And, you know, it's nice to have money, but you're not going to take it with you. So you might just as well try and make good use of it, and as long as you can, you know, feed your family and so forth, why not? Mm-hmm. I don't consider that a risk. I consider that, you know, a thing to do.
How about satellite? Is it the same logic? It was out there. It looked good. We ought to have it, too.
Well, as I've said many times, satellites were invented for Alaska. It just had to be because
sure.
With the area size we had, there's no way of ever getting microwave up here, get live TV, or even live radio on an economical basis. So when ComSat started the Communication Satellite Corporation, when Congress created that corporation in 1964, I immediately went out and took some of Northern TV's money and bought 5 shares of stock. That's how much I thought about satellite communications. But then it took some time before we really could make use of it. But, you know, when you can illuminate all of Alaska and all of the world with satellite communications, it's absolutely the only way to go. And we first made use of it when we could get a circuit to bring CBS up full-time. That was we were the first radio group to do that. And now everybody has live news and live sports and live everything. It's more interesting than, you know, hitting a piece of toilet paper with a pencil. And then TV, it took a long time. It wasn't until 1984 that we were able to bring in same-day network programming when the networks were very slow in using satellites to transmit programs because in the South 48 they had such a good microwave system through AT&T. And when AT&T started overpricing them, then they went in the satellite business.
But there wasn't any rush before that.
There was no rush.
See.
We were anxious. But the networks weren't. But when they finally went that way, it was a natural for us. And now there's all kinds of sports, you know.
Wasn't your station the first station to bring sports just a week late when you brought the NFL?
Well, we used to bring up on film and then on tape, tape-delayed sports. We were the first station to bring in a live football game.
Oh, live football game.
Live football. And that was November 3rd, 1971. And that was after ComSat put in the Earth Station at Talkeetna, the Bartlett Earth Station.
Right.
And I had a lot to do with that because through the Broadcasters Association, we encouraged ComSat to come up to the Broadcasters Association meeting here in Fairbanks in June 1967. We brought up the chairman of the FCC, and I was a chairman of Governor Hickel's Satellite Communications Task Force. And we brought those people up through the Broadcaster Association, but before they came here and gave their speeches, I got them to every potential user of satellite communications in the business, the military, the business people, and all. And ComSat was impressed enough with Alaska that 6 months later they had a task force up here and determined it was a viable thing, and that started the Bartlett Earth Station at Talkeetna. So once it was in place, then we could, it was very expensive to begin with, so all we could do, the networks allowed us to sell all the commercials in, and that was unprecedented too. But that's the only way, because we had to pay for bringing it up. It cost $6,000 to bring in a football game. $2,000 an hour is what it cost for satellites.
And could you get the advertising for
that? Yes, we did.
You're listening to an archive edition of Sunday at Noon that originally aired in 1990.
In case you've tuned in late, we're talking to Augie Hebert, a broadcasting innovator in the state of Alaska. He was granted an honorary doctorate in public service from the University of Alaska in 1973, among other awards and accomplishments. You said about RatNet, the Rural Alaska Television Network, that it probably never turned a dime, but it's important to do because it takes information, entertainment, sports out to communities that would never receive them.
Well, it was never meant to be a commercial thing, and it doesn't mean anything to the commercial broadcasters. It was created by the state of Alaska, the legislature, in 1976. They came to the broadcasters and said, we think we should be able to provide some mechanism with satellite communications upon us now and technology available to bring TV entertainment to remote places. And they wanted to start a demonstration project, and it's called a TV demonstration project, and it involved 22 communities. The broadcasters worked on it for a whole year, and we had some concerns. In order for us to allow them to take our network programming and retransmit it out to villages, we had to get the approval of the networks. The networks were very concerned about potential violation of copyright. Somebody might copy it and, you know, sell the programming to Saudi Arabia. The copyright problem was risky, and just it was new, and, you know, when you're trying to deal with somebody in New York on something new, it's very easy for them to say no. So, but what we told the broadcasters, worked it out, came up with what we thought was a feasible plan, but we told the legislature then, whatever you do, don't start something like that. Develop an appetite in the bush for it, and then take it away. Just don't do it. Yeah. Well, it seemed to be, well, at any rate, the person in the state that was working in Division of Communications, a man by the name of George Chaganaugh, and I went back to talk to the networks. I represented the broadcasters at all three networks in January of 1977. We explained it to them. They said, we'll give you a year's trial, and if we don't have any problems with this, then come back in a year and tell us. And it started on schedule January 15th, 1977. It worked very well. There were surveys made on how well it worked, and people were happy with it. The legislature provided more money to expand it, which they did. And George and I went back a second year and reported to the networks. They said, fine, we've had no problem with it. Continued on, but, you know, we have the right to stop it at any time. Hmm. And so it's continued on. Now there's a jeopardy problem. Perhaps you've seen some publicity about there's a bill before the Senate, which still has to go to the House. Concern is that there are beer commercials in sports and programming, and that's damaging to the people in rural areas. And there is an assumption in Juneau that they can go to the networks, or the beer companies can go to the networks, and because of the compelling reasons here that the networks will allow the commercials to be deleted out of the programming. Part of our affiliation contract and the networks look at allowing the programming to go out in remote areas as an extension of our contract, our affiliation. Our contract says that you cannot delete anything from a network program or add anything to a network program. And all networks are exactly the same way. It's a copyright problem, and it's a severe problem. So we've been trying to tell them in Juneau that this is it. And it's a legal problem. And if you go back to the networks and say we want to monkey around with this, they're very apt to say, forget about the whole thing. We just can't be in jeopardy.
Well, this is something that's still got a lot to be worked out.
It still has to be worked out. Yeah. One of them, there's a severe liquor problem in remote areas. And I don't. I testified in a teleconference before the Senate committee, the senator that brought this bill up, and I tried to make it clear that I'm not for. It doesn't make any difference to our station whether any of the programs go out or not. It doesn't make any difference to the networks. They don't get any revenue from it. They have a potential great amount of risk and aggravation. But really, when you stop to think about it, there was a problem out in the bush before RatNet was started. There's a problem out there before before TV was invented. Mm-hmm. Advertising goes in newspapers and magazines, and that those media still go out to the bush. So will they really accomplish a whole lot by what it will mean is in order to send programming out the bush, they'll have to buy syndicated programming at a couple million dollars a year. They won't have the highly visible and highly desired sports programs out there, like a Super Bowl and things like that. So does it make an awful lot of sense to do it that way, where the basic problem of alcohol in the bush someday has to be solved by education?
Same coin, perhaps a different side. People talk an awful lot about violence, and less so, but still some people object to the level of sexuality on television these days. As a broadcaster, how do you feel about people saying that violence on television leads to violence in the streets? Is it the same thing?
I think there's a connection there to a certain extent. I don't think there's as much of a connection as a lot of people would imply. There's a lot about today's television programming that I don't like at all. There's a lot of suggestive programming and outright sexual innuendos on network programming today that when we first started television, they wouldn't condone at all. And I think it's pretty bad. And I think the Federal Communications Commission has started in the direction of trying to clean that up. The networks, you argue with the networks, and I've done plenty of that, and they said, well, you know, we're not leading. We're just following what the social mores are these days. I'm not so sure that's the case. It might be to a certain extent, but I find in our home that when my wife and I see on a whatever network, they're all the same, somebody hops in bed with somebody else, we're off on cable and looking at a program that used to be decent, early day network that's family-oriented. You're not ashamed to turn on in your living room. It's unfortunate. I hope it turns the other way someday. I don't think it's doing society a bit of good, whether that's what they want or not.
What do you? And again, this is the same sort of question, same sort of coin. What's your sense of the responsibility of radio and television to honor, test, utilize to its fullest the First Amendment, freedom of speech? Is that a job of yours?
Well, surely, yeah, I think so. We've been in a funny position for many years. You know, in the early days of television and radio, we couldn't editorialize. It was illegal to editorialize. And this is comparing to newspapers that can and do. That's their stock and trade. Well, finally, the Federal Communications Commission came around and said we could editorialize. And then you have another thing that's called the Fairness Doctrine, which I really subscribe to. I think it's a good idea. But in some respects, it really inhibits broadcasters from doing what they want to, too. During a political season, for example, if you put on one candidate for an office and have a discussion show, mm-hmm. you really have to put them all on, to be fair, and you get some of them that you can't conduct a program. They're crazies. There was a radio station in Anchorage that tried this, and one guy came in with a .45, a gun. Mm. They didn't know if he's going to be violent and shoot somebody, and they had to just cancel the program. So it kind of limits what you want to do and how you want to do it. And then, but by and large, it's changed a lot. We've come a long way in that direction, and I don't really see that broadcasting is prevented from really fulfilling a good First Amendment responsibility anymore at all. I think we're in pretty good shape on that one. Took a long time to get there.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of, this is a left turn here, what do you think of, what do you think is the innovative edge in technology now? Where do you look next to expand or interest yourself?
Well, you know, most people look at me and say, gee, I understand you've retired. And I keep telling them, no, I go to work every day and maybe I should retire. But I don't really have any clear idea of what I should do next. I hope that I can continue to keep working. And I think it pleases my wife a lot because she doesn't want me underfoot at home. But as far as going into new businesses, I don't really think there's very very much out there that I should get involved in now because they won't be around long enough to be able to follow it through. And I'd hate to start something that might be risky and somebody else would have to worry about.
How about innovations or technology within the medium?
Well, there will be plenty of innovations and technology changes as time goes by. One recent one is digital audio, which gives you absolutely noise-free and very good fidelity audio. Television quality has improved a lot, and there'll be more of that come along. Tape machines, when we started, videotape was 2 inches wide and ran 15 inches a second. Now you get a better quality reproduction on one-inch tape that barely moves. There'll be more advances there. I think the next big means of transmission that will have an impact is direct broadcast to the home. By satellite, you have a little dish the size of a football on your roof and get programming that way. And whether that's going to be a threat to free broadcasting or a threat to cable, I'm not sure. Probably a little bit of both. But believe me, there is a technological possibility there that probably will mean the development of what you've heard so much about, high-definition television, because they will have the broadband capability of transmitting a marvelous picture with the same kind of quality as you have on 35-millimeter film right into the home. And that will advance that technology, which in turn will be coming into homes by TV as soon as the Federal Communications Commission decides on which system to use. There's a lot of competition on which systems to use. So that will be a big step, and maybe 10 or 15 years away, but it will have an enormous impact on the quality of TV in your home. It costs a lot more for the set, too. It'll be a big consumer item when it comes about. Beyond that, I think the other two-way communications, you know, by satellite, we now have cellular phones that have a relay point on a mountain somewhere. We'll be talking to each other with a handheld device via satellite around the world, no question about it.
Just cellular phone I've got now, remote phone.
It'll be great for a guy out fishing or hunting. If he gets lost, he can tell where he is, call in help, and so forth.
I think about that. He can just dial a number, can't he?
Sure.
I've sunk the boat. Come get me.
Yeah, and right exactly where he is. It's that's a telecommunications innovation I think will come about. In terms of better quality and to prevent piracy of signals, fiber is going to be big. Well, that's the telephone company here is installing it right now. That's a marvelous innovation. It's another, as a matter of fact, as far as intercontinental communications, that's going to in turn replace, supplement at least, satellite communications because it's secure and you can't shoot it down.
Right.
You might have to go under the ocean to figure a way of cutting it, but you won't be shooting it out in case we get into trouble.
You know, we've come to the end of our hour. I have one last question for you. This is a question about advice to people starting out now, people 50 years younger than you. You, it seems to me, you're self-taught and taught yourself all along the way, from engineering all the way through the many intricacies of sophisticated broadcasting. And it also seems to me that you operated on grit and courage to try new things, and also on your word to follow through. Everything I've read about you says that you're good to your word wherever you go. I don't know whether that's all right to say or not, but I'm interested in what you would say to young people. What are the most important qualities to, if they're going to be a business person or an innovator in beginning in 1990?
Well, you can't beat honesty and the work ethic. That's pretty basic. One thing I would say to anybody that has a skill or is interested in a skill is to, you know, come on up here and get into it. There is no better place than Alaska if you have a skill and you want to come up and exercise it. You can always find a job, and if you work hard and keep your nose clean and you can always advance, and if you want to, you can go out on your own. That's one nice thing about this country is you don't have to have a background of where you come from or whether your blood is blue or red. If you prove yourself in a workplace and you keep good credit and so forth, you can always go out and get financed to do something if you want to do it on your own. So with that in mind, I would say the field is wide open. 50 years later doesn't mean a thing. 50 years from now, there still will be many opportunities for young people. They're not going to get it in a lazy manner. They're going to have to work for it. And then the results will be commensurate with how hard they work and how well they do.
So the same rules apply today?
Same rules.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wouldn't say there are any other rules. I haven't found any new ones.
Augie Hebert, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I'm Susan McGinnis.
Susan's conversation with broadcast pioneer Augie Hebert originally aired on KUAC in 1990. This summer, I'll be airing archive editions of Susan's show. For Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.